Sai Ram, dear listeners, welcome to yet another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show where the questions are yours and the answers are Swami's. But me? Well, I'm just the co-explorer. The questions don't merely belong to the person asking the questions, neither is it specific to that person's situations alone. It's a question that either bothers us and we have not asked anyone and someone else is voicing our concerns, or they are questions which are hidden inside and we have not given much thought to them. It's like when we were in a classroom, you know. Sometimes we are shy to ask the teacher a certain doubt that has been nagging us all through the lesson. Then someone else raises the very same doubt and we are happy that at least somebody asked. But sometimes, at the end of a lesson, we feel that we have understood the lesson completely. And then someone asks this question and you ponder, I didn't think of that. Yes, that's a very valid question and I would love to know the answer. I guess the questions we receive on the show are like that. At least I can personally relate to most of the questions asked on this show. And I'm grateful to all those who have asked questions because they have given me and all of you the opportunity to dive deep into Swami's revitalizing message. But above all, let us offer our pranams to Swami who has created this entire opportunity for all of us. So this week I'm going to be continuing the answer that I was giving Sister Saraswati from Chennai. She asked two questions and as I could not answer both last week, I'm going to continue with the answer this week. As some of you might have noticed, my answers are getting a bit longer now than earlier. The idea is to take the opportunity of the question to delve deeper into one aspect of Swami's message. In fact, that is the whole purpose of the various situations we face in life, isn't it? To make us go within and ask deeper spiritual questions. The question can indeed wait, for we are not yet done with the quote of the day, isn't it? And today's quote is from one of the Indian spiritual giants from the 20th century. That's none other than Ramana Maharishi. I quote, "Correcting oneself is correcting the whole world. The sun is simply bright. It does not correct anyone. Because it shines, the whole world is full of light. Transforming yourself is a means of giving light to the whole world." End of quote. Well, when I play out the question for this week, one more time that is, you will realize that the quote has a connection with it. Who among us can claim that we've never had this urge or desire to go and correct somebody around us? I think all of us want to correct the world. Because we constantly feel that the pain, the sorrow, the problems that we face is because of the problems in the world outside. I'm not saying that we must completely turn a blind eye to the mistakes around us. Do take to correcting those around if it is your responsibility. If you are a teacher, a parent or an elder in the house, yes, you certainly have to advise and correct people around. But what is being referred to in this particular quote is a little different. The world is way too large for us to fix. We can at least start with ourselves. And the fact is, if we choose to fix ourselves, even this whole lifetime is not sufficient. Swami would say, watch every word you speak. Make conscious decisions asking yourself, is it right and wrong every moment? In the process, you will automatically become a reference for others. The analogy Ramana Maharishi gives about the sun is beautiful. Even Swami would refer to such an analogy. The sun does not really interfere in our life, does not do good or bad. It does the job it is meant to do to the best of its ability. And that way, we benefit from it. Swami would say the same about something like a street lamp. It just stands there shining its light, doing its role perfectly. And when it does so, it throws light on others' path. A measuring tape never measures us. It is just perfect as it is, and that is why we are able to use it to measure. Same is the case with each one of us. Let's be perfect as we are. Automatically, we will become correct. We will become references and help people correct themselves. But in the process of being perfect, in the process of playing our roles to perfection, if we have to advise others or correct others or point out others' mistakes, we have to do that too. I hope, Sister Saraswati, that answers one of the issues you raised in your question regarding correcting oneself and correcting others. Well, I'm hoping it'll become clearer as I go through the answer. But before that, permit me to read out the quote by Ramana Maharshi one more time. I quote, "Correcting oneself is correcting the whole world. The sun is simply bright. It does not correct anyone. Because it shines, the whole world is full of light. Transforming yourself is a means of giving light to the whole world." So before I continue with the answer that I started last week, I think I'll play Sister Saraswati's question one more time. Then we will take it on from there. So I'll repeat the same question. As I said, one part of the question we answered last week. The second part is yet to be dealt with, but we listened to the whole question nevertheless.
Sai Ram, Brother Prem, I am Saraswati from Chennai. Firstly, I take this opportunity to congratulate you on successfully completing 1 year of answering booth. May Swami bless you. I have two questions. Question number one. I am very particular about keeping my house clean, which involves some acts wherein I have to chase away lizards, use some insect repellents in the cupboards, whereby cockroaches, ants and other insects get killed. Does my act amount to sin or non-violence? I do not know any other means to keep my house, which is Swami's gift, clean and tidy. I have heard about many experiences where Swami is very particular about cleanliness. What is my dharma as a homemaker to keep my house clean? Question number two. I am a very soft-spoken person, usually do not interfere in others' issues. Swami's Chinnakatha about Ramakrishna Paramahansa correcting his disciples Brahmananda and Vivekananda for being too meek and being too rude respectively set me thinking. Also the fact that the world is not suffering because of adharmic people but good people not voicing or reacting for the acts done by adharmic people. I have also heard of some instances where Swami says, do not try to correct the world, rather try to transform yourself first. As a Swami's devotee, what is my role? I am unable to correct my own family members at times. I am not in a position to tell them that they are wrong. I am confused as to how far I can remain silent and when is it warranted to point out their mistakes. Sai Ram, thank you.
So that was the question, and as I said the last week, I dealt with the first part of the question, which is regarding the dilemma between causing harm to some creatures like the pests and keeping our home clean. So probably to start with a brief summary of the answer that we went through last week. The harm that we cause can very, very broadly be classified as harm that we cause consciously and unconsciously. The conscious harm that we cause can be, if it can be avoided in a practical manner, I think that is the working term there, pragmatically, practically, if it is possible for us to refrain from causing that harm, then I think we should as much as possible. And even if we cannot serve and care for other beings, at least we can start by not harming others. That's why some of these practices such as being a vegetarian, not harming any creature for the sake of the joy of it. In fact, I think in the past, Swami has corrected a lot of devotees who had this habit of going on a hunt. They used to go hunting deers and hunting ducks. Swami has weaned away people from that. Consciously avoiding such acts which, you know, without any purpose cause harm to other beings. That is about the conscious harm that we do. And the unconscious errors, we went through that beautiful discourse which Swami spoke of where he gave us the 5 yajnas that a householder performs and how sticking to those 5, actually they're not out of the way ritualistic yajnas, but things that we do in everyday life. So Swami is saying how that counters the unconscious harm that we cause to beings around just because of leading a regular normal life. Now the real issue is about the conscious harm which is inevitable, right? You know that you're consciously harming somebody and you're asking, I'm not able to stop myself from doing it for various reasons, and that is the question about. And this is where I am going to draw a parallel between the two questions. And I said that these two questions are fundamentally related and this is how they are connected. Let me explain that. Now you are by nature a person who is reserved and calm, right? That is what we can gather from the question itself. That is what makes it more difficult for you to do something that might hurt others, right? That's the basic idea. So that others may be small creatures, insects and pests, or it could be people around you, in your family, in your friend circle, or even in your workplace. And both these cases of dealing with pests at home and a situation where you have to tell someone that he or she is wrong at the risk of hurting that person or making that person feel bad is a case of conscious harm that is actually inevitable, right? That's why I said both of these come under the category of the conscious harm that we cause, but it is inevitable. In the case of dealing with pests, you know, you've gone ahead with your action and you've got your house clean. I think that's what you've done. But you are wondering, is it all right? Will it bring karma? Is it a form of sin that I'm performing? In the case of your second question, you're asking the question before you indulge in the action itself, or you are choosing not to act and you are wondering, is it all right? So that is how these two questions are really connected, and I hope you understand the connection which I mentioned even the last week. Now from the answer that I gave you last week, when I say the answer, I know the answer was very long, but I started off by the answer by giving a one-line answer, which is nothing but Swami's answer to the very same query, right? So now from that answer that we got from Swami, we will try to draw an answer for the second question, because if the two questions are connected, then the answer that Swami gave for the first question in relation to pests should be a guiding light for us to gather the answer for the second one too. So now what was Swami's reply? And as I said, if people are joining me this week and were not with me last week, the same question about a householder who has to deal with pests was put to Swami by Dr. Hislop, and Swami's answer in one line, and I'm just reading it out as he has noted it in his book, Conversations with Baba. Swami says, there is nothing wrong in keeping the home free from the assault of these small creatures, but only where you are, your area. Generally, Dr. Hislop is very, very meticulous when it comes to noting down Swami's words. So I think we can go by what he has written. That might be precisely what Swami would have said. Now, why did Swami say it is okay? Because it is the duty of the householder to ensure cleanliness and thereby safety of the people in the house, right? Since that duty is more important, that duty makes this conscious harm that we are causing to these creatures an inevitability, right? So that is why it is okay, because you have a larger dharma, a larger duty to perform, and that duty is making this harm that you are causing inevitable. And the important statement I feel that Swami is making there is, in your area, where you are. That is what Swami is saying. Well, it does not mean that keep your home clean and don't bother about other places. I think that's what most of us do in India, sadly, but that is not what Swami is referring to. There is a subtle meaning in what Swami is saying. When he says, in your area, what Swami means is, if it is your duty, if it is within the scope of your role, then it is not wrong. So I hope you understand that, Swami saying that there is a certain action that you have to perform, and when you perform that action, some people get hurt. Swami is saying that causing that hurt is okay, it is not a sin, it is not bad, if what is making this harm inevitable is the role that you have to perform, is the duty that you have to perform. And this is what Swami refers to, and we've heard Swami speak about this many times, is what Swami refers to as Swadharma. Dharma is, of course, roles and responsibilities and the right actions to do. Swadharma means, is it your dharma? At that point, the roles that you are playing, whether you're a householder, whether you're a mother, you're a wife, you're a citizen, all of those roles define for you what is your duty at that moment in time, at that moment in space too. And that is what is referred to by this beautiful word called Swadharma. So if your Swadharma is in that situation, is the cause for the inevitability that you're causing harm, then it is okay. I hope you got that point. So if Swadharma is the cause for the situation being inevitable, then the harm caused is not a sin. So sin is a much larger word than just saying karmic consequences. I hope that we'll clarify as we go through in the answer. But what is the cause for that inevitability? If it is your Swadharma, then it is all right. Well, this is the very essence of the advice actually that Krishna gave to Arjuna. Krishna said that, Arjuna, you are a Kshatriya. To fight is your dharma. To protect dharma is your duty. So don't worry about the harm that you will cause, because under your dharma you are under the compulsion to do this act, even though physically it might harm somebody. But since you're doing it under the umbrella of your Swadharma, it does not amount to sin. This is one of the most important things that Krishna tells Arjuna, which is applicable to all our lives. Well, talking about Krishna and Arjuna, Krishna was also cautioning Arjuna about another inevitability, which is what we all generally struggle with. You know, when we indulge in an act that may hurt others, it may be because of many reasons. It's not just because it's our role, it's our responsibility. We spoke of this idea of Swadharma being the cause of inevitability. But another form of inevitability could be our own nature, right? When in a situation, if I'm short-tempered and if I react to some harsh words which are spoken against me, I'm actually expressing my nature. I'm not actually doing my dharma there. Even though to speak up might be my dharma, I am not doing it as an act of dharma, but I'm doing it as an act of expression of my nature, right? So our anger, jealousy and sense of revenge sometimes, when that backs our act and we hurt someone, we could be doing it out of any of these emotions, and that becomes the inevitability, not the dharma. Dharma is not causing the inevitability, but our emotions and our nature is causing the inevitability. Maybe that's the reason behind this episode of Ramakrishna reprimanding Vivekananda. Maybe that situation required the person to give a firm reply. And that's why he says, Brahmananda, that, you know, you're being too meek. So that situation did require someone to speak up when the guru was being reviled. But Vivekananda reacted not under the compulsion of Swadharma alone, but also out of his own nature. And we all know Swami Vivekananda, especially when he was the young boy in Arin. He was the quintessential angry young man, isn't it? So when Vivekananda reacted, it was not completely because that was the right thing to do. It was also because that was his nature. And same is the case with Brahmananda too. And that is what was being pointed out by Ramakrishna, saying that you reacted too much or you reacted too little. Now, so the working point that we have to take from that is, doing the right thing alone is not important, but doing it backed by the right emotion and propelled by the right motive is also equally important. Now, this emotion or the thinking that backs the action, why is it important? Why is it so important? Because finally, we are all judged by our actions. We are all judged by what we do. So what is the necessity to go one step backward and see the motive, see the emotion? This is a very, very important point, because, you know, there are a lot of people who get misguided by this. When you see the external appearance, you see a person and say, oh, he's doing a lot of good work. It is not about the actions that you do. It is not about the work that you do. You might be doing the best of charities. You might be apparently serving a lot of people. But if the motive which is driving that act is not right, then the entire act actually has a different color. So that is why it is important to go into this. See, when we started the answer last week, I said we all naturally agree that doing a harm unconsciously is not as dangerous as doing something consciously, right? When you consciously hurt somebody, it is definitely, we all, I think, intuitively know that that is more bad than somebody unconsciously doing. So even when we talk about karmic consequences, that is not only about our way of looking at things, even when we are talking about karmic consequences and our acts adding up to sins or merits in that sense, this is what stands, that what we do consciously is heavier than what we do unconsciously, right? So that itself suggests that the motive or the emotion that is driving the action is what makes an action heavy or light, as I'll be explaining in this next part. And for that, we'll have to go into one particular concept which the Bhagavad Gita talks about, which is very, very important. The concept of karma, akarma, and vikarma. But what makes explaining this concept very, very difficult is the word karma itself. Because the word karma is so multifaceted and can be used in different contexts. For instance, karma, you know, it can mean that what is one's dharma. What is one's dharma is also referred to as karma. One action, the actions that we perform, they're also referred to as karma. One's fate is also referred to as karma. And consequences of our acts are also referred to as karma. So that is what makes this idea of explaining karma, vikarma and akarma very, very difficult. So for the sake of clarity, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to use the word actions for referring to what we do, right? Actions for what we do. Consequences for the immediate repercussions of our actions. And the word karma only for what becomes a huge consequence that gets carried from life to life. So this is literally like the code which we're going to use for the rest of the explanation. So I'll repeat it again. I'm going to use the word actions for what we do. Consequences, the word consequences for the immediate repercussions of our actions. And the word karma only for what becomes a huge consequence that gets carried from life to life. Now in everyday life, you know, we perform a lot of actions. You know, right now I'm sitting here, I'm speaking over the phone, that's an action. Somebody might be sleeping, that's an action. Somebody might be eating, that's an action. That's what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that everything is one form of action or the other. So all that we do is a form of action. So there are many things that we perform in everyday, like eating and sleeping and bathing and reading. Much of these actions which we probably do without much thinking. You know, we just do it every day. We get up every day and we brush our teeth. We get up every day and we shave and we have a bath and all of that. We don't think of it much. So all of these actions will have consequences which are easily noticeable. I keep brushing my teeth regularly. I have healthy teeth. Let's say I don't brush my teeth for a few weeks, a few months. The consequence of that action is immediately visible. You can see that probably my teeth are getting yellower or I'm going to develop cavities. So there are these activities which we do every day, almost unconsciously, without much thinking, without using our emotions much. I think more than thinking is we don't involve our emotions in these actions. And the consequences of these actions are quite immediate. You know, we can see it within a perceivable time frame, right? I think it's not just about these actions which are physical, like what I mentioned, but there are many other small actions which are also included in this, which could even include some of the daily problems that we face. The problems which we face at home, the problems which we face in the office. When I say problems, they are situations. Like you wake up today and there is a leak in your house and that needs to be fixed, right? So to fix that, you need to perform some actions and you just do it unconsciously. You just do the needful, right? And if you don't do the action, then you see the consequences. If you do the action, the leak stops and that's the consequence. So like that in life, there are many small situations that we go through in everyday life, in professional life, where, you know, there's a situation, you know that you need to perform a certain act to solve that situation. And you do what is necessary. So even those will have immediate consequences. Now, let me take it to the next level. These are the regular actions that we perform which have immediate consequences. And this also suggests that this is why we should never give up the practical approach, right? There is no replacement for the practical approach. The daily problems that we face, the regular issues that we have, let's say your kid comes home and complains about a certain problem at school, it has to be dealt with practically. You know, the idea of looking at karma actually comes much later. What has to be practically dealt with has to be practically dealt with. And that is because much of the actions that we perform come under this category of regular actions, which if performed, there is a certain consequence. If not performed or if delayed or if not performed the right way, which will have a certain consequence. It's a direct thing. Now, let's go to a different example where, let's say I'm working with my colleagues and there is my colleague who does something wrong. And I tell him that, you know, this is wrong, don't do it this way. So let us say that we have some task to be performed, and as a team we are coming together and we are saying that this needs to be performed. And somebody says, let's give this work to so-and-so, this colleague who I've identified has a certain problem. And as a member of the team, if I say that, no, let's not give him that work, I don't think he's suitable for that. Probably, you know, he will fit in somewhere else. So let's not give this task to him. This is a choice that I'm making from a very, very practical point of view. It's not like I don't like that person or I have any problems with that person. I feel that this person does not suit this role, so I say let's not give this role to him. On the contrary, let's say that I have some kind of an issue with this person. I'm upset with that person, I'm angry with that person, I've had some issues with him earlier. And this situation, still what I said is the same. He does not fit the role. So still I'm going to speak up in the meeting and say, no, let's not give that work to him because he does not fit the role. But in the back of my mind, this anger is also there. And I'm also trying to get even with him. And I'm also trying to put him down because I've had this issue with him in the past. I might be doing the same thing which I would have done very, very practically. But this time I'm doing it backed with emotions. I'm doing it backed with an ulterior motive, which is more than just being practically applicable to that situation, right? When I do that, the same action which I would have done practically, when I do it motivated, that will become karma. And just to give you a reference, karma is the word we are using it for consequences of actions which are going to become so large or so heavy that they might be carried on from birth to birth. It's like a stain which becomes more strong and more difficult to remove from the cloth. So these actions which are motivated by our emotions, our anger, or a particular thought, a strong sense of emotion becomes a karma. So when actions are propelled by these strong emotions, they will have heavier consequences and they will become karma that can be carried forward to different births. And when will we have such strong emotions? The same example which I give, where does the strong emotion come from? When there is a strong sense of doership and enjoyership. These are big words, but you can relate to it. You know, there is a certain sense of continuity. As I said, there is a certain past with this person. I'm remembering that. I'm having that grudge in my mind. And I'm saying, you did this to me. I'm going to do this to you. So when there is a strong sense of doership, I am asserting myself and I'm asserting my choice. I'm asserting my free will to do something and say that I am doing this so that this is going to hurt this person, or I'm doing this so that this is going to benefit this person. So one of the most important characteristics of what we refer to as actions which become karma are this very, very strong sense of doership, right? And I think this is a clue which we have to hold on to, because when we're looking at solutions for our karmas, this is one of the key solutions. And of course, I think most of you will be aware of that. So keep this in mind, that those actions which result in karma are, one, backed by this very, very strong sense of doership, and is backed by emotions such as anger and jealousy and greed, or sometimes very, very strong attachment. And for that, I mean, let's not go into good or bad. All emotions, when they back a certain action, they will result in karma. In fact, I had made this point in the passing when I was talking about joy, where one of the persons had asked about the different kinds of joys that we feel and that we experience in life, and I'd made this point that let's say that you give me a sweet to eat, or you tell me that tomorrow why don't you come home, I'll make a sweet for you. And when you give me the sweet is going to result in a certain sensation in my mouth. I'm going to feel happy about that. That's what we refer to as pleasure. That when you eat it, then it gives you certain pleasure. Now let's say that you call me and say that I'm going to make this particular sweet, will you come home tomorrow? And let us say that sweet happens to be my favorite sweet. So the moment you tell me that I'm making the sweet tomorrow, I'll give you some tomorrow, I'm already starting to think of that sweet and I'm already starting to enjoy the moment when I'm going to eat that sweet much, much before that moment actually comes. And maybe even after eating that sweet and getting that pleasure, for probably a next few hours or a day later also, I'm going to be thinking of that moment when I had that sweet and I'm going to be enjoying that. So that is what actually the mind can do. When the mind gets associated with an action, it can make that moment much, much larger than just those few minutes that action is performed or that sensation is felt. So that is what makes it so very strong. And same is the case when someone harms you, right? Let's say if somebody does it by mistake, or you feel that somebody just did it by mistake, you will not carry it in your mind. You know, somebody trips me when I'm walking and I just believe that it's a act of, it's an accident. So I'm not going to be carrying it in my mind. But let me say that I think that person did it personally, and I mean that person did it intentionally, and that will result in an anger, and I will be carrying that in my mind for much longer. So that is what the mind can do. When the mind associates with happiness, or when the mind associates with pain, it can extend the period of that pain and joy. Same is the case when we talk about the mind getting involved in the actions that we perform. So when the mind, when our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings get involved in some actions that we perform, they do not remain normal actions which will have immediate consequences. They will become actions which have karmic consequences, right? And Swami says that this action based by emotions of attachment, anger, jealousy, hatred and so on is what is referred to as vikarma. So vikarma is that kind of action which will result in a karmic burden, in a karmic consequence, be it sin or merit. So let's keep this aside for now. We've defined vikarma, one more factor. Vikarma is an emotion-backed action. And when one strongly and willfully does something, right, that becomes vikarma. So vikarma is defined by, one, the emotions and thoughts and feelings that back it, and this very, very strong sense of doership. So when you do an act with a very strong sense of doership and saying that I am choosing to do this, I am doing this, and you know I'm doing this because I want this result, because I want this at any cost, I want to hurt this person, I want to achieve this, that becomes vikarma, right? So very, very significant point. That is one definition that we've got, vikarma. Now moving on, now let's come to another point, very, very significant point, and which is also very relevant to the question being asked. And I think the way I'm going, some people might think that it's got nothing to do with the question. So this point is specifically related to the question that was asked. And this again is something which Krishna speaks of in the Bhagavad Gita. The significant point is that karma is not accumulated by actions alone. Karma can be accumulated through inaction too. I think that's a very, very important point that the Bhagavad Gita teaches us, that karma is not accumulated by actions alone. Karma can be accumulated even through inaction. So let's go back to what Krishna and Arjuna were speaking. Arjuna had a dharma to perform, like that's what Krishna was trying to drive home. Arjuna had this dharma to perform to fight the war, but his emotions of attachment was stopping him from doing his dharma. So an emotion coupled with inaction, this is a case of emotion being coupled with inaction. Of course, it didn't happen because Krishna made him fight the war. But what Arjuna was heading towards was an inaction which was backed by a certain emotion, in this case, attachment. So even that becomes a form of vikarma, which will lead to a heavy karmic burden, right? So in your family, let's say someone does something wrong and you want to point it out. If you are by nature a very hurtful and a sharp person, you may tell the person that he or she is wrong, but you will put your emotions behind it. Because, you know, if you are of that, there are some people who derive joy by hurting others. I'm sure you're not in that category. If somebody is like that, at that point, to point out the mistake of the person in the situation is right thing to do. But if you put your emotion, if you put your narrow-mindedness behind this act and you are criticizing that person, that becomes vikarma. Or you are too soft to say that that person is wrong. And so you refrain from saying, you refrain from acting, and you remain silent. That is also vikarma. So, you know, I hope you understand how complicated this is. You know, we can accumulate karma while doing our dharma and while not doing it. And we can accumulate karma through actions as well as through inaction. Right? So literally, it is like we are in a quicksand. You act, you're doomed. You don't act, you're doomed. You think you're doomed. You don't think you're doomed. It's literally like a situation like that. You're in a quicksand. It's just pulling you, right? And that is the complication that we all are in. But if you don't think of any of these things, if you just go by the flow of things and you say that I feel angry, I'm going to speak. If I feel happy, I'm going to speak it out. If I feel sad, I'm going to walk out from there. I don't like this situation. I'm not going to be in it anymore. You keep going life through your whims and fancies, then none of these problems will actually apply to you. The whole thing comes when you ask yourself, what is my dharma? What am I supposed to do? And when that thought comes, what does Swami expect me to do? I think it becomes very, very complicated, and it is necessary to go into all of these things, right? And one of the old students was once telling us, it seems in an interaction, Swami had told them that, you know, if you speak one word, it is too less. If you speak two words, it is too much. So one word is too less and two words is too much. And then Swami, with a very mischievous smile, he said, Swami alone knows how to strike the balance between the two. And definitely that's what it is. And, you know, that's again probably a hint we'll come back to in how to solve the problem of what are we supposed to do? When should we speak? When should we not speak? Because I think all of us go through this situation. I mean, I'm not speaking this from the idea of me giving you some advice, because I think all of us do this, speak in the wrong places, keep silent in the wrong places, act in the wrong places, and don't act when we need to act. And of course, we sometimes speak at the right place and act at the right place too. So we do all of these mistakes. So that is where we stand, right? So when we are in situations like this, you know, first of all, how do we handle that? So, first thing is, we'll have to look at ourselves, look at the situation and ask ourselves, what is my dharma in this situation? What is my swadharma? Which role has to be given importance? Because when you talk of swadharma, like suppose the sister who's asked us this question, there are multiple dharmas which constitute the swadharma. The dharma of a wife, the dharma of a daughter-in-law, the dharma of a daughter, the dharma of a mother, the dharma of a neighbor, all of this constitute the swadharma. So you will have to find out or ask yourself in this moment, which of these dharmas have to get precedence and which is the role that I need to play at this particular point. So in any situation, the first thing that we need to do is ask ourselves, what is our dharma, right? And on top of that, our emotions. And our emotions are something that we have no control over, right? That's the whole problem. So one thing is we don't know which is the dharma which is predominant at the moment. And the other thing is we don't have control over our emotions. So in this way, we are whatever we do, whatever actions we do or inactions we indulge in, all of this keeps leading to karma. And karma means that which keeps getting carried over from birth to birth. So Swami says that you get into this endless cycle where whatever you do, it's going to lead in you coming back. You do good, you come back to enjoy. You do bad, you come back to suffer it. And this goes on and on. So the thing is, what is the way out of this? How are we going to get out of this? Each of our actions becoming vikarma and vikarma becoming karma. The most ideal option, which is the best way to come out of this, is Krishna very easily says, do nishkama karma. Do desireless action. Well, if I was desireless, then I'll have no problem at all. Right? If I was really desireless, nishkama means desirelessness. So if I was really desireless, I will not even wonder if my actions are going to lead to merit or demerit. The very question where, oh, I'm doing this thing, I'm cleaning my house, will it lead to sin? Which means there is some desire of not doing harm or some desire of let me do merit. So the very fact that we all have some form of the desire, nishkama karma is probably not the best option for us right away. Like, it's not the best advice for us off the shelf. It's not like I can take it and start using it. Eventually, yes, I will have to lead up to that point where I'm constantly only performing nishkama karma, and that is the way that I get released out of it, right? But what I need to do is, I need to find a way by which, as I said, there are actions, and the actions become vikarma because of the emotions involved, and when the emotions gets involved, it becomes karma. So I will have to find a way by which, instead of actions plus vikarma giving karma, is that a way by which actions plus vikarma will lead to what the Gita refers to as akarma or non-action? And that's what Krishna says, that there are some way of doing actions. If you do it in that way, even though you are acting, you become the one who is not acting. Even though you're performing actions, you are actually not performing actions. Your actions don't add up to karma, but they add up to akarma, or being inactive, or you're not creating more and more karma, which is going to pull you again and again. So one of the ways is, of course, nishkama karma. Let's keep it aside a bit, because that's the most ideal situation, and we will keep it in our mind. That is our, you know, eventual goal. We will try to get to that, but we will have to come back to a more easier way of doing it. And that is why Krishna gives the option of what you refer to as karma yoga, right? Karma yoga is all about doing the actions you have to do, but can you do it in a manner that it will release you from the cycle of birth and death? That is what karma yoga is all about. So what is this karma yoga? And spoiler alert, what I'm going to say now is not anything new. I think I've spoken about this n number of times, and before me, I think any number of speakers on radio and on other programs would have spoken about what is the idea of karma yoga. But nevertheless, we'll speak about it a little bit so that we complete the answer and we complete the concept itself. So what is this karma yoga? First of all, the first part of that phrase, karma yoga, is karma, which means the first thing that you have to do when you wish to take to this path of karma yoga, which is eventually everybody has to take to this, because that is again something which Krishna tells Arjuna, that nobody is exempt from action. If you're born in a physical body, you have to perform action of some sort or the other. Even if you're a sannyasi, you're performing actions. Even if you are a child, you're performing actions. So karma yoga is literally something which all of us have to take up to at some stage or the other. So having said that, karma yoga, the first word in that phrase karma yoga is karma, which means, first and foremost, as I said, we need to ask ourselves, what is the role that I need to play in this particular situation that I'm in? What is my dharma? As I've said many times on this program, it all starts with that question, what is the right thing for me to do? And for us as devotees, if we have to inject devotion into that, instead of asking what is the right thing for me to do, we ask what is the thing that Swami would expect me to do. It's one and the same, because Swami will expect us to do what we are supposed to do. So when we talk of karma yoga and the first part of it being karma, which means first and foremost, we need to do what is necessarily our role, what is essentially our duty at that moment. This answers some questions that some people ask us. When you talk about nishkama karma, they generally ask, what if I kill somebody without any desire? What if I indulge in some bad action, but I have no desire of the outcome? You know, nishkama karma, but the karma is bad. It can never happen like that, because karma yoga by definition starts with one asking this question, what is my duty? Am I doing my duty right, in the right manner, right? So that is how it starts. You first have to do your duty, and there are many slips in that. As I said, it's not easy. It's quite complicated. One of the things which Swami speaks of, I told what is our duty at that moment. We refer to as Swadharma. And in Swami's Dharma Vahini, so beautifully Swami explains that Swadharma does not necessarily mean your individualistic dharma for that moment. Swa also means the Atma. So Swadharma is also referred to as Atma Dharma by Swami. So one of the ways of dealing with that is following your conscience every time, following your conscience every moment, asking, going within and saying, Swami, is this the right thing I'm doing? If I'm doing the wrong thing, please stop me. If I'm not doing the right thing, please inspire me to do the right thing. So one way of finding our idea behind the Swadharma is to turn to the conscience and make that a habit, right? That is one of the things. Now, there is a certain form of vikarma that you can perform. As I said, vikarma is actions backed by emotions. There are certain forms of vikarma that you can perform which can literally lead to a karma, or in other sense, this vikarma literally becomes like a fire which does not now make the actions that you do heavy but starts burning it down to ashes. And what is that kind of vikarma that we can do? First of all, let's go back to that clue which we dropped some time back, saying that the strong sense of doership is what is one of the important components of vikarma. Can we give up this idea of doership? It's not easy, of course it is not. I mean, if it is, we all would be doing it right now. But one way of doing it is, as Swami would say, that much of the actions that we perform are performed because we have been put in that situation, right? Today, if I have been put in a certain situation, I'm here. I mean, my role is to be a presenter on the radio. My role is to give speeches on Swami. As much as possible, I do the role, first of all, with as much perfection as I can. That involvement is very, very important. Because karma yoga essentially means doing whatever you're doing to perfection. Yoga karmasu kaushalam. I think it's a statement we have mentioned many, many times. Perfection in karma is something you cannot discount at all. Do it with perfection and do it with the feeling that I have been put in this place and I am instrumental in the work that is happening through me. Same thing can be said about any role that we play. Let's say that you are a mother, right? And you have been put in that place. Swami says, understand that you've been given this role of being a mother to this child, and I will perform it to the best ability I can, to the best I can. I'm not going to think that, oh, I have given you so much love, I have given you so much, I have made you study, I have worked so hard for you. No, you do that role with the idea that I have been placed in this situation, and I'm going to look at what is the best way I can play this role, and I'm playing it as an instrument which is meant to dispense this role. And this is what is referred to in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna looks at Arjuna and says, Nimitta Matram Bhava Savyasachi. Savyasachi is, of course, the name of Arjuna. So he says, Nimitta Matram Bhava, which means just act like you are an instrument. Be the perfect instrument, but don't act with the feeling that I am doing this, I am exerting myself, I am exerting my emotions, and I am choosing to do this, I am choosing not to do this. Give up that idea and try as much as possible to become an instrument in whatever situation that you are in. So the first one, as I said, is to play the role that we are supposed to play. You know, use all your faculties. Swami says you have to use your buddhi and ask the question, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing it the right way? Can I do it better? Is there anything I'm missing out? You use your discrimination to perfect your action, and all the time act with this emotion that you are instrumental. You are nothing more than a nimittam or an instrument. That is one way, one form of vikarma, where you back your action with this idea of I am just instrumental. So I am not looking at what are the benefits I can get from it. I am not looking at how I can harm somebody with the tool which I have. When you are in authority, when you are in power, you are not asking yourself how I can exert my power and authority, but you are only asking, I am an instrument holding this power, how do I dispense it to the best ability I can, right? The third one, of course, is the most important, which again we have spoken so many times about, again, which Swami has spoken at length about. This idea, can we back our actions with one emotion, which is a very, very important emotion, this form of vikarma is supposed to be the most beautiful, which Swami has advocated so much, which even Krishna advocates extensively in the Bhagavad Gita, which is with the feeling that, Swami, I am doing this act as an offering to you. The feeling of making an act an offering is also a form of vikarma, because you are attaching an emotion to an act that you are performing. The moment you attach this act, this emotion, that Swami, I am doing this as an offering to you, and I am not worried about what comes in return, because whatever comes from you is no more a consequence of my act, but is your prasadam. I am detaching my action from the karma, at least in my mental level, in my mental equation, it is no more the same. Whatever I do it as an offering to you, and whatever comes to me is your prasadam. I am not going to see it as my karma or a consequence or a result of my act or the reward for my act or a punishment for my act. Whatever comes in return becomes your prasadam. And Swami says that this is one of the most ideal and the best way to put an end to this cycle of action and reaction. So in a situation when you are, probably I'll be summing up with this, you know, the question that you asked about, I'm in a situation, I don't know whether I'm supposed to speak up or not speak up. This is the order in which we'll have to look at it. First of all, do you believe that it is your role to speak up? Do you believe that by speaking there, you are performing the role that you are performing at that moment ideally? Your answer may be right or wrong. You might end up in a wrong cell, you might eventually end up doing the wrong thing. It doesn't matter. What to start with is to ask that question. That's what Swami would say, that many, many parents don't play the role that they have to play of being strict with their children because they don't want to become unpopular. Yes, becoming unpopular is the immediate consequence of your action. But to not be worried about that and say that to perform my role to the best ability, should I speak up? Should I not speak up? If I don't speak up now, can I speak to that person privately and drive the lesson home? Because I have no issue of, I mean, this idea of let me put that person down in front of others, or let me show him or her that he's wrong. If that attitude is not there, I think you will only be looking at the situation and ask, is there a better way to solve the situation? Is there a better way to perform my duty? And I think that is what needs to be consuming you every time we act. And the second thing, as I explained in the quote that we spoke about, you know, when is it, I mean, do we have to pull ourselves away when we have to correct somebody and say that, no, I should be bothered only about correcting myself, I should not be worried about correcting the other person? No, if the role that you are playing calls for you to correct others, if that is a part of your swadharma, then I think you have to perform it. Because this process of doing our action to the best of our ability is itself a process by which we will be correcting ourselves, we will be purifying ourselves. And of course, talking about the vikarma, as I said, the idea of being an instrument, trusteeship, which you've spoken so much about, then the idea of making every act an offering. And with all this, probably I will attach it to one thing which I made a passing reference to in last week's answer, when we were talking about one of the yajnas, which was Daiva Yajna, which Swami said, reading spiritual literature, reading, listening to discourses, and constantly keeping your mind occupied with spiritually elevating content. What does that do? That also has a very important role to play in the actions that we perform, because as our consciousness raises, we are going to be raising ourselves from these petty feelings of anger, jealousy, greed, and all of these things. That is what is spiritual progress. If that doesn't happen and you're only gaining some spiritual powers, it's not spiritual progress at all, according to Swami. That inner purification is the ideal definition of spiritual progress. So when we raise our consciousness through our other activities that we do, be it Namasmarana or meditation or literature, what we refer to as self-learning, Swadhyaya, when we do all of this and raise our consciousness, as I mentioned last week, the color of our karma changes. Our karma start becoming lighter and lighter and lighter, and we will be heading towards what Krishna refers to as the ideal state, where you are performing nishkama karma all the time. So nishkama karma does not mean doing whatever you want to do and you know, saying that I'm doing it without any desires. No, doing what you're supposed to do and not having any desire of the consequences. Well, this seems very, very complicated, but it is actually not so complicated, though it appears like, if I do, I'm doomed. If I don't do, I'm doomed. What do I do? You know, I often think of it like when you first learn to drive a car. When the first time you learn to drive a car, I know what a burden it is in your mind. Oh, I don't know when to change the gear. When I'm slowing down, should I come from the third to the second, or am I okay? You're constantly looking at the road, you're looking at the speed, you're looking at the gear you're in, and you don't know. That's so much of a burden on your mind. But once you get used to doing these 3-4 tasks, who doesn't like a long ride? And this idea of shifting from one gear to the other and pressing on the clutch and accelerating and slowing down happens so naturally that it no more becomes a burden on your mind. Your mind is only enjoying the cruise. It's only enjoying the ride, right? And that is what will happen in this act of performing our duty, where without any effort, we will be doing these 3 steps. We will be seeing what is the best way I can play my role. Constantly you'll be telling yourself, I'm just being an instrument. Whatever is happening is only happening through me. And at the end of the act, or during the act, will very naturally you will make it an offering to God. And as Swami says, whatever comes, you will accept it as Swami's prasadam. I thank Sister Saraswati for asking these 2 questions. I think it gave us an opportunity to speak about something which makes the Bhagavad Gita one of the most practical scriptures that, you know, we can go back to in modern spirituality, and go back to many, many concepts which Swami has spoken about. And even if you look at what Swami has said about the Bhagavad Gita, I think these are some of the things which Swami constantly refers to, constantly speaks about, because these are most relevant to our everyday life. And I think the question was so beautiful that it gave us an opportunity to delve on these concepts over 2 weeks. I only hope and pray that I could do a good job of explaining it to you. I, of course, leave it to Swami. I offer it to him. And once again, thank you, Sister Saraswati, for those beautiful questions. So thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. This is going to be the wrap for this week's program, but do join me again next week for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. I'm going to leave you with a song which was recorded for one of the sports meets. It's one of the most popular songs in Swami's hostels. Even when I was a student, this was one of the chart busters, if I could say that. I'm going to leave you with that song. If you have a question, like Sister Saraswati, and you'd like to put it for me on this show, feel free to write to me. You can write to me to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to me will be read only by me. Confidentiality is guaranteed. If you don't want your name to be mentioned, you can let me know. I will not mention your name. And like Sister Saraswati, if you can record your question in your own voice, I think that would be more than perfect. It's always wonderful to have somebody else's voice on the program. Otherwise, you'll have to listen to me for 1 full hour, and I can guess that could be quite boring. So thank you for joining me. I most humbly offer this at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with this song, which is a very beautiful song. On the other side of it, you will have Raghu's program at 12:30. I'll be back with you with another episode of Afternoon Satsang with Arvind. And I'm sure this week's Afternoon Satsang will be quite interesting too. So do join us again at 12:30. But next week, 11 a.m. on Radio Sai, Answering Booth. Yame malichina madhurama.
ಕೋಯಿಲ ಕೂಸಿನ ರಾಗವಾ